It's called the Ed-Skill Solution question mark, because actually I'm not 100% convinced that we have a solution. And that was earlier described as pessimism, but actually I want to view the flip side of the coin, which is it's a really interesting set of very, very hard computer science problems. And you know, that's the world, if you like, that you're going out into. These are some of the challenges that are there facing you that you'll be able to work on. So just to remind you of what those challenges were, we had the four challenges set by the DARPA review: power consumption, memory and storage, application scalability and resiliency, IAM validation, and all of them require fundamental computer science research, either for new hardware designs, fundamentally new methods of working, and some of them, perhaps even all of them, you will have to do in collaboration with others, whether these are the electronic engineers who design the chips, or the physicists, the engineers, or whoever who wants to run the problems themselves. And lastly, and by no means least, are the mathematicians to work on the fundamental algorithm. So one of the things that we started going last summer is a consortium called NAIS, Numerical Algorithms and Intelligent Software. And this is a collaboration between 55 institutes, mathematicians at Edinburgh, Heriot-Watt and Strathclyde, with your informatics colleagues at Edinburgh, and then my own institute in EPCC, to have a look at how you would develop the next generation of numerical algorithms and produce them in a way where you have a number of constraints. One of them, you want them to be highly efficient on parallel architectures. We've had far too long this idea that you design a numerical algorithm in serial and you graph the parallelism on later. So get the idea of parallelism in from the outset. And in order to implement that effectively, you need to give the compiler a lot more steer about what bits of the code are indeed parallelizable, what bits of that are inherently serial. And so we're working with Murray Toll and people in his group at Edinburgh looking at skeletal programming. There is also activity going on with Michael Boyle and the compiler optimization group, just how do you compile these codes optimally. So there's a whole range of things happening there, and I think that the intellectual challenges are truly exciting wherever you keep looking. Just in the same way that DARPA had that look at what were the challenges facing exascale computing hardware back in 2007, there have been a couple of studies recently looking at the software challenges that exascale would have produced. One of them is by this group, IESP, the International Exascale Software Project. It's an ad hoc group of people drawn from around the world, mostly computer science orientated, but not exclusively so. It is rather dominated by the US, but it has had a number of surprising international effects. The first of them, for example, being that the G8, the group of eight leading industrial nations in the world, have decided to make a call for research projects. First time they've ever done this. And what's their first research project? Exascale computing. Now, you might think that this was really good and exciting news, and indeed it is to some extent. The US backed their exascale activity with hundreds of millions of dollars. And we were sitting here in the UK and feeling a little bit jealous. And so when the G8 call came out, I thought, well, look, if US is putting in hundreds of millions of dollars, surely when we have eight nations coming together, you can expect more hundreds of millions of dollars. Well, they put forward 10 billion euros, and they say, well, we're going to fund around like 10 projects with 10 billion euros. It may sound a lot of money, and indeed, if you're a starving student, it is a lot of money, but actually, when it comes to doing research, this is chicken feed. Nevertheless, the kudos associated with having one of these is very significant, so we're all working quite hard to try to make proposals at the moment. But let's go back to IESP and their study of exascale computing. What did they recommend we should be doing? Well, there were a number of key things that came out of their work over the last year. The first of them is that we could no longer design hardware and software independently. You have to take a co-design approach. That was, you had to design both in parallel. The second was that if we were to do this, we had to have really critical, societally relevant, if you like, applications that needed this exascale computing. I talked about some potential possibilities earlier on, but we needed more evidence to be able to generate these societally relevant applications. So doing quantum chromodynamics or some other very theoretical particle physics calculation, which you probably could run on an exascale computer, wasn't justification enough, despite what some of my physics colleagues say. So the idea of these so-called co-design vehicles is also one of their recommendations. In other words, you develop codes in parallel with the hardware, which can use the hardware. They may not be as relevant as you might like, but they become icebreakers. They teach you in practice what you can and cannot do. And so the hope is that we will be able to design some of these things, and they'll give us ideas about how to generalize the applicability. So they were the key recommendations of how to move forward. How did they think we were going to achieve them? Well, the IESP report is a fairly thick report. It boils down, I fear, to one slide. What they say you have to do is you have to design a system stack, which they call X-Stack. And X-Stack is going to do all of these wonderful things. It's going to support the current programming models, provide software tools that will directly manage the power, make your software resilient, address changes to heterogeneous nodes, I haven't quite touched on this point yet, I'll come back to it, and solve the parallel I/O bottleneck. Well, jolly good. In any of the other pages, did it tell you how we're going to do any of those things? No. What it did do was it came up with a list of topics where it believed that fundamental computer science research was necessary. This is not a complete list. This is my abbreviated version. And you're not meant to be able to read it. All you're meant to be able to do is to accept that some of the world's leading computer scientists in this type of area identified a whole range of research projects that we needed to solve. We needed to solve them by about 2019. There are enough PhDs in that level of law to keep everyone in this room and many other universities happy for an awfully long time. One word which will come back to us time and time again is this word that I used previously, which was power. The ability to handle the electrical power, I don't mean the performance, but the ability to handle the electrical power of these things is absolutely critical. And so, if I read off one or two of those, power-aware compilers, intelligent power management, power-aware ships, and it comes up again and again and again. mentioned heterogeneity a moment ago. Let me elaborate a little on that. In my review in lecture two, I said that today's parallel machines were essentially homogeneous. There may well be a few specialist nodes in the machine that handle I/O disk or something like this, or your front end where you'll do compilation, you might do some pre-imposed processing. But by and large, all the computational nodes are the same, and all the computational nodes are fairly basic and boring single units like a single microprocessor. IDSP believes that that model is going to change and change quite radically. The nodes will become heterogeneous, and the heterogeneity will not itself be constant. In other words, this thing over here in the machine could look quite different architecturally to that one over there or this one over here. And what are the components that make up this node? Well, there are a number of them. You could start a microprocessor, you could have some form of GPUs, some form of graphics processor, which is not necessarily there to do graphics, but is there to take advantage of the specific architecture of the chip for to speed up computational kernels. You could have something like an FPGA where you try to modify the basic hardware of the FPGA, compile the code if you like, or the kernel of the code, to run on all that FPGA and hardware. There'll be a great richness, they believe, in the underlying hardware architecture. And somehow, we have to manage that. We, in this context, is either the application programmer who has to understand exactly what's going on and when he places or her places the components on the machine, know what the different underlying nodes look like and code accordingly, or in the ISP view, the extract will do that all for you seamlessly. So we're looking at a much more complicated and rich environment. And in many senses, this is almost going back to the old days of parallel computing 20 odd years ago, where architectures looked very different from each other. They still might have looked pretty similar inside, but we're going to have to take account of variability anymore. So going back to your comment earlier, how do we do this if we're a hands-on type of hyperdrive? Well, on these sorts of architectures, you're going to have a lot of different things in there. You might program in this bit in Fortran, that bit in CUDA, that bit in VGL, or something like this. One of the problems of the IESP document was that it made these statements about the software and the hardware without going into a lot of detail on the hardware and never really linking the two. And that makes it a little bit difficult for some of us to really understand what actually is involved. Fortunately, there was another study. The other study was also carried out by a group funded by DARPA. Again, this one took place roughly a year ago. Again, it was focused on software. But this time, they looked a bit more at the hardware and tried to say, if this is the software stack that we're trying to produce from applications down to the bottom, what is it that we have to build on? And they did a study based on what they called straw men. And these straw men, two straw men are discussed here, first of all. There was the so-called heavyweight straw man. This is a machine architecture, very much like you would see in things like Hector, the Cray XT4, or even any of the Cray XT series. What have you got? You've got essentially a standard, an industry standard microprocessor, some directly attached memory, a proprietary interconnect, and virtual machine. The microprocessors are the latest state-of-the-art processor that you have in your PC or something. So these are heavyweight because the individual processors are the fastest, most power expensive because the top rate is high. But they're the fastest microprocessors that are around today. Then there's the lightweight straw man. And the lightweight straw man is typified by machines like the IBM BlueJean. So if you remember back to the previous lecture, these machines like BlueJean have a very simple computational, a simple microprocessor. They run relatively slowly. In BlueJean L, the first generation machine, which is the thing shown here on the right, the clock rate is 450 MHz. The next generation machine, the one that you currently buy from IBM, is around about 800 MHz. So we're talking about very slow power. But lots and lots and lots of microprocessors tightly connected by a proprietary interconnect so that the latencies are low, the bandwidth is as high as you can get, and you pack them into a small box. So there are the two straw men, heavyweight and lightweight. What they wanted to do then was to see whether using these essentially standard architectures that we have around today, could they design an exaflop machine? In order to answer that question, the evolutionary straw man is my sort of global title for heavyweight and lightweight, because they're evolving from machines commercially available today. In order to answer that question, they then made a number of assumptions. And you can see the principal ones here. The first of them is a statement about the likely needs of applications. So they assume that in 10 years' time, applications will need roughly the same ratio of memory to processing capability as they do today. They also assumed that microprocessor dies would be around about the same, that Moore's law would continue, so that on a die of a given size, that you get more and more components on it, as typified by the number of cores, but that the leveling off of the clock speed that you saw earlier on, that will also remain stable. They assumed, however, that we're going to be able to get more flops per cycle. At the moment, we can manage around 92, and they thought that in 5 years' time, we'd be able to get 8 flops per cycle. And then the last two are very much down to sort of solid engineering practicalities. That you can manage to increase the power to a rack by a factor of 2 roughly every 3 years. Now, if you don't know what power to a rack actually means in real terms, that probably means relatively little to you. So let me talk about a typical high-end machine today, again like Hector's Cray XT4. A rack is a thing about the size of a wardrobe. It's so wide, it's about so deep, it's about so high. And the power consumption of a rack like this, depending on exactly which one you've bought, is anything around 20, 40, maybe even 50 kilowatts. So when you think that you've got some tens of 1 bar electric fires in a volume the size of a wardrobe, that's putting out an awful lot of heat. And today, most machines are air-cooled. In other words, they suck in air probably at the bottom, pull the air up through fans and push it at the top. But we've pretty well reached the limit of what you can do with air cooling. So to take machines like this, which are already stretching the envelope of what you can prove, and assume that you can double that power density every 3 years, is optimistic. But they're being optimistic as well. The other thing they said is that the number of racks in a machine could increase by around about 50 per year. There are 60 racks in Hector, the UK's largest and fastest computer. So this 50 racks a year is really adding, you know, the UK's HPC facility pretty well every year. So again, this is generous or optimistic. So there's nothing in those numbers that made you think that this darker panel were shrinking violence. They were pushing things a little bit. Are they reasonable? Well, anyway, let's not answer the question of are things reasonable. Let's answer the question of, if you make these assumptions, where do you get to with the two different straw men? They also, I should have said, helped to make another assumption about memory utilization, memory versus microprocessors, in terms of energy consumption. They've got these two models, simplistic and fully scalable. Remember that memory is taking ever more energy as a percentage of the total. The simplistic assumption, which is that the maximum power per die grows in line with the ITRS projection. So this is, the ITRS is, if you like, the semiconductor industry roadmap. And that simplistic assumption is true if the energy that it takes you to move a bit decreases as fast as flux increases. Now, we saw the graphs earlier on. We know that this had not been the case for the last 30 years. But let's take the other assumption, which is fully scaled. And this assumption is true if the energy per bit moved remains constant. Now, this one is more realistic. And let's have a look at what happens with the heavyweight strawman. So what we're doing here is we're taking current machines, the dots down the bottom left here, and we're trying to use those statistics or those parameters to scale current leading edge machines forward in time. And if you take the simplistic assumption with regards to the amount of energy that you need to put into the memory, you'll see that you turn off about a factor of 10 below the exaflop. We can get to about 100 petaflops and no more. If you take the more realistic statement about the amount of energy that it requires to drive your memory and the memory bandwidth, then in fact it's an order of magnitude less. You get to about 10 petaflops and you're done. And interestingly, you know, this full model here is only a factor of 10 bigger than the fastest machines in the world available today. So if these sorts of assumptions are actually borne out by practice, we will see this turn off really very soon. So there's the heavyweight strawman, and if you believe it, it tells you that machines like Hector, Cray series machines, will start to top out in the next few years and won't get much bigger than they currently are. So how did the IBM BlueJean lightweight strawman model work out? Oh, okay, let's talk about power cost. They had a They had a pain factor as well. They said, well, we can probably afford 25 megawatts to run one of these machines. Remember, Hector, these sorts of things, it's around about 1 megawatt. So they reckoned that no one would ever build a machine more than that. Even with their simplistic model, this machine that I just showed you on the previous slide is over 100 megawatts. That's quite a lot, especially since you have to add up peripherals. So, doesn't look particularly attractive. At least we understand how to program these things, because we've got them at the moment. We may not necessarily know how to scale up to those levels, but at least we know how to program them. But they're difficult to build, perhaps completely uneconomic. How's the straw man do? Same approach. We take today's machine, we scale forward, and here, if you take the optimistic model of memory power consumption, you can indeed get the exaflop. And you will in fact do it at around about 20 megawatts. If you take the more realistic, fully costed model of memory power, then we're still about an order of magnitude short on a factor. 3, 5, I'm sure. But so this model is undoubtedly doing better. It looks like it has more long-term scaling. The challenge is when it comes to the power bill again. None of these are anywhere close to this 25 megawatt pain threshold. I know that it's terribly boring to come back to this power word again and again and again, but the truth is that the engineering demands that are placed on by the power problems can be so large that they just stop you in your tracks. So what would it mean to try and power a machine like this? Well, if you go and you try to build yourself a pyramid in the UK, and you go to your electricity provider and you say, please give me some power, then unless they put in a special line for you directly from the power station, the most you can get out of the mains on secondary circuits, they call it, is 7.5 megawatts. You say, well, I know about doing things in parallel. I'll have more than one. I'll have two of these 7.5 megawatt cables going into my building. And then the power company said, no, you won't. Because they're worried about slight phase differences between the two power supplies. And they don't want phase differences causing some form of short inside the building or something like that. So they will not be very happy with you trying to draw more than 7.5 megawatts on the secondary circuit. So if you're going to try to build a machine room to house one of these machines, you'd better have built in the costs for your own electricity supply, in Sir Patrick's case, all the way back to Long Island. And that's serious money. So, practical problems, solitaire. I'm not suggesting that any of you in the room are going to research the practical problems of the electricity provision. All you have to do is come up with a microprocessor that's 100 times more energy efficient. That's the easy one. Student project. The required level of parallelism for either of these strong end proposals is on the order of a billion. So if you want to use the machine as a whole, and of course, what's the point of doing using a small fraction of it? It would have been much more cost effective if you bought a small machine. If you want to use the whole thing, then you've got to think about having a billion threads working concurrently and interacting with each other. So there's a significant challenge there. And indeed, the Dharma Committee thought these challenges were sufficiently large. They thought, tell you what, let's go back to square one and see if we can design our own microprocessor. And they called this one the aggressive straw man. They had one design characteristic in mind. Design a microprocessor that gave you the minimum wattage per flop. And I'm not going to go into how they actually designed it, but they designed some sort of thing. They made an assumption about the sort of technology that would be available to them. The 32 nanometer silicon technology isn't particularly aggressive. We're pretty well there at the moment. They have this statement, is that they would have aggressive voltage scaling. Now, anyone who actually can explain what that statement means, I would be very grateful, because they never actually explained what the statement means. And the problem you have is that you have to have a minimum voltage across the semiconductor and actually get the semiconductor to work, and we're not that far from it at the moment. It's absolutely true, the closer you can get that voltage to the band gap difference, the less the voltage, and therefore the less the fan consumption. But they've made some assumptions about voltage, of which they are, shall we say, silent, in order to try to address some of the problems. So I think one of the things is you have to interpret this point is there's a bit of magic happens. Anyway, this is their microprocessor. This is the one they want to build the machine out of. And here's the machine that they propose to build. It's going to be just a whisker short of an exaflop, 997 picoflops. To do that, they're going to put in just a bit short of a quarter million microprocessors. Each microprocessor, and here's where I start to sigh, each microprocessor will have 742 cores. I said earlier that I slightly despaired with the Intel 80 core one, and here we have an order of magnitude less. Sorry, an order of magnitude one. There's going to be lots of cache, 37 terabytes of it, to be exact. There's going to be lots of DRAM, i3. Even with all of these constraints, trying to squeeze the maximum number of flops per watt, they don't hit their 25 megawatt target. They're still a factor of 0.3 to that. And lastly, and from my point of view, most horrifyingly, they work out what the memory bandwidth and the network bandwidth is. So I think that's horrific and unachievable. And I think these numbers beggar belief. So let's work on the first ultimate problem. Memory bandwidth of 0.0025 bytes per second per flop. Think about what it means to do an ARM. One number in, another number in, one number out. You might think, therefore, that for that floating point operation of the ARM, you might like a bandwidth to memory of around about 3 words. 2 in, 1 in. And obviously you can put things in registers. So you don't really need it. The 3's the Rolls-Royce. In today's petascale machines, people grumble because actually this ratio of memory bandwidth is around like 0.3 bytes per second per flop. That is a factor of 100 less. If you want to put a number out onto the network, you want this microprocessor to talk to this one, then the bandwidth is a factor of 3 for the next one. So, this machine, immense challenges in terms of actually using it. We know, because we've got real evidence of this from real applications, is that we're already limited by memory bandwidth and here with this iteration can make a difficult. What they say is, go back to strong scaling. What you've got to do, you've used this weak scaling for far too long. What you need to do is you need to get applications where you can keep the problem size fixed. Think about Amdahl's law again. You keep the problem size fixed, but you do more work on each iteration. So please go off and find a set of applications that exhibit strong scaling. The truth is that we tried this for 20 years and there are very few that do it. I mentioned things like parallel compilers in all this context. And by gum, do you need them on this chip? This chip runs so hot, effectively, that you cannot use the ALU, the arithmetic unit, at the same time as the memory interface. Certainly not if both of them are going at full speed ahead. So you better have a compiler that says, do that calculation, don't use the memory interface, because if we use both of them together, the chip will melt. Challenges for you there. So these things are really power constrained. Obviously, there's a lot of work to be done in terms of the system software and all of the drive. I put a question mark in the title of the talk, the exascale solution. I don't know how to get to an exascale. I can tell you how not to get to an exascale. There are the six good ways of not getting to an exascale. You can ignore Little's law. Little's law is one of the very, very basic queuing laws that you have. And in this context, you can apply queuing theory to what this is. And what it tells you is that the required concurrency, the degree of parallelism in the application, better be the latency times the bandwidth, or else you just waste. Don't use processors engineered for serial applications. In other words, the heavyweight strongman isn't going to get you to the exascale. You've got to use a slimmed down microprocessor. Don't rely on weak scaling, because as we've seen, weak scaling requires bigger problem sizes, lots of data has to be shipped around, and you'll not manage to drive that. If you synchronize your data communications, that's bad news as well, because everyone then waits for someone else to finish. And so there's a lot of delay built into the application, especially since the signals will take a long time to get across the machine with these very low network bandwidths. And if it's bad on a sort of processor-to-processor or processor-to-a-few processors, it's even worse if you try to put in barriers for global synchronization. Finally, if you use an algorithm, a numerical algorithm, which is designed to minimize flops, you're probably doing the wrong thing as well, because it's the memory accesses that dominate the time and the energy consumption. So that's what not to do. That was an easy list to compile. The list of six things to do is slightly different. I wanted to come back just briefly to explain again this challenge of weak versus strong scaling. Because it's not always that obvious exactly what's going on. Weak scaling, as I said, is this problem where the problem size is proportional to the machine size. So you machine with twice the amount of processors, you give a problem just twice as big. And strong scaling is where you have a fixed problem size. You saw the example of weak scaling in those two last ultimate charts that I showed earlier on, where you have small problems, the code is dominated by serial or global operations, and it slows down. So, why do we have to give up on weak scaling? can we not just, on these exascale machines, keep rescaling doors on? And the answer actually comes down to this problem of algorithmic complexity. So let me give you an example of this. Here's a pretty simple algorithm. What I want to do, I have a number of particles. Each of them are moving at some velocity around. They have associated masses, and they're interacting with each other through the ground. So it's easy enough to write down an equation which calculates the net force on each particle due to all of the others. That's just good old Newton's law summed up. And because we have n particles in this thing, and this is summing over all particles, then this application scales as n squared. So where's the scaling problem in this? Well, if I were to take the double the number of particles, the fact that this is an n-squared algorithm means that the computational load goes up by a factor of 4. I try to use weak scaling and map this new problem onto 4 times the number of processors. That's the thing that gives me the Gustav system, or the fixed load per processor. Well, I've only got twice the number of particles. So the number of particles that are stored on each processor therefore halves. If the number of particles on each processor halves, what effectively happens is that the surface area of the particles goes up compared to the volume contained by the particles. And so there's a lot more surface area to volume, and that means that the number of data exchanges between this bit of space and this bit of space next to it goes up.
And you can address this with duplicating particles, which is, I think, done in some situations already. Why doesn't it work in this example?
Because you run out of memory. If you try to use a replicated data model, which many of the old chemistry applications do, then you're constrained by having the maximum number of particles being the number that you can fit on any one processor memory. And if you want to do a big simulation, such as a billion particles simulating the universe, you need to cut the particles up across the processors. You're looking puzzled. So you can't afford to you can't afford to simply use a straightforward replicated data. The challenge here is, as I said, the data exchange ratio rises, and since it's the memory bandwidth or the network interconnection bandwidth which is stymieing you, these things slow down. And so what you really would like here is you would like an algorithm whose complexity is order n, that is, it's linear, or ideally you'd like an algorithm with complexity less than n, and I'm afraid those things don't exist. I mean, they're the same as the buy one, get one free offer at Tesco's. If you have twice as many particles, it would run faster than you get n, so obviously you head for infinite number of particles. So the algorithms simply don't exist. After all of this, the challenges and what have you, I wonder how, in some sense, do I sum up my feelings about the exascale challenge? And it struck me that it felt very much like taking an old technology, the horse and cart, and strapping a rocket into it. It might get you somewhere really rather fast, but I'm not entirely sure that I would want to travel in it. At the same time, I don't know how many of you have been to the Smithsonian in Washington, but if you have been to the Smithsonian in Washington, you'll see that there's there an example of a craft that really pushed the technology of its day way past past any sensible design limit, and actually did take people to the moon in this case, and back again, in a way that you simply wouldn't have predicted. So the simple answer to the question is, I do not know. I don't know whether it's the horse and cart with the rocket motor attached to it that's pushing a technology, silicon technology in this case, further than really physics would actually push it, or whether it's an example of the lunar module pushing a technology to a point where actually it might not be comfortable to use, but it is useful and it does a job. I didn't quite want to finish there because I wanted to come back from the sort of very rarefied heights of high performance computing to mention parallelism in everyday life. And this is the sort of thing that when you're going to do your PhDs or you're going to work in the software industry, you're much more likely to come across and try to have to deal with. This aggressive stroma that I put up, this custom designed chip for high performance computing, is unlikely to be made by any big manufacturer, an Intel or an AMD, expecting that it will have usage outside a specialist niche market. From my point of view as a computational scientist, that gives me a question of, if I really do have to go back down the custom build route, who will build these things for me? I can't simply phone up IBM and get them to deliver one tomorrow. More generally, though, Moore's law is, it keeps on going in the way that we see in the Intel roadmap, it's going to give you this problem in everyday applications on everyday servers. And I don't know what the economic drivers for Intel are, but clearly, as we said before, you know, I'm going to replace this laptop when a number of things happen. Either it falls apart, or, it probably falls apart. I'm not obviously going to replace it when the microprocessor gets old, because the next microprocessor that comes along is no faster than this one. There's no impetus for me to do that. And the challenge for Moore's law is that that's what we're seeing. We're seeing more cores. You might not be able to actually use them in a sort of functional parallelism sense, have the operating system run on one and browser on another, a game on another, or something like that. So how do you design the killer app for multi-core microprocessors? And that, I think, if you wanted, a PhD, which we